Hello, hello. You're listening to the Goggler Podcast. Uma, Ian, and Bahe with you. And today, it's a special episode dedicated entirely to Wonder Woman 1984.
Just 84. No 1980. No 19.
It's either WW84 or Wonder Woman 1984. The hashtags are very confusing. we've been waiting 6-7 months for this. It's been delayed and pushed and... I guess now the biggest controversy surrounding the film is that it's being dropped in the US in cinemas and on HBO Max at the same time. But because we live out in the boondocks where there isn't any HBO Max, we got to watch it in cinemas. But before we get into the review, just a quick reminder, if you're enjoying this podcast, as always, don't forget to tell your friends and family. You can find us on all of our social media feeds on GogglerMY. Also, you can go to goggler.my to listen to the podcast. Subscribe on Spotify, Apple Music, Google, Overcast, wherever you get your podcasts. All right?
And we should say as well, this will be a spoiler-free review up until a segment later on. We'll keep everything till the end so you can turn off before then.
All right, let's get into it. Wonder Woman 1984 sequel directed by Patty Jenkins, of course. All the cast are back. They've added Kristen Wiig and Pedro Pascal, who play the villains of the piece this time. And here's the thing. Before this podcast, I was trying to figure out how to summarize the plot of this film. And then it occurred to me that there isn't much plot to summarize. like without getting into spoilers, because they find a magic stone, and it literally is kind of called a magic stone in the movie that grants them wishes. And then bad things happen. That's essentially the whole film.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm not underselling it, right?
I think even saying that there's wishes is kind of a spoiler. Like, I would have said that, like, Steve somehow ends up in her life and Pedro Pascal starts amassing power and no one knows why. And Kristen Wiig is there.
Okay. Wait. Let's get the good things out of the way. So,
short section.
No. No, the good things are, I think it was really great to see Chris Pine and Gal Gadot back on screen together. They have great chemistry, and all of the stuff that was written for them I found very charming and a lot of fun. And that banter felt, I know there's probably a better comparison, but one that everyone can get behind, that banter felt very MCU to me, right? Mm. It felt,
but not in that jokey MCU way. Not way that people assume with Whedon and S stuff.
It felt like comfortable. Yeah,
yeah. It felt like 1914 all over again.
Exactly. Mm.
Like they do. It just feels like they've continued their conversations from then. Only, instead of him show. I mean, it's a reversal. Instead of him showing her a whole new world, she's showing him a whole new world.
They even have a magic carpet ride. Hey.
Yeah.
Kristen Wiig and Gal Gadot also have fantastic chemistry. And I'll get into the bad stuff about that because I don't feel that was built up very well. Because I saw a lot more potential in that, because that brief lunch scene, which we see
in the trailer,
had potential for a lot more great moments. And I felt that a lot of that seemed rushed to get to the big bad guy, big fight, big cool set piece. Which seemed to be what this movie was. Like a series of very cool action set pieces, most of which you've seen in the trailer, all strung together with some talking in between.
Well, I think that's like something you pointed out after we watched the film was there's a whole opening section and it's supposed to be thematic for Diana, but actually we might have been better off just losing that completely to have more time in the modern day Diana's life. Like I don't think it... And it's a big... It's online, right? They put it online, the opening section.
Yeah, they did.
Is a big special effects thing, but the message they got from it could have been achieved a lot quicker and a lot less showy. Like, it doesn't... It's kind of cool, but I was like, at the point, I'm like, I'm watching Gladiators. I don't know, was it called American Gladiators over here?
American Gladiators,
We had both, actually. Because Gladiators, there was a British one, and then there was American Gladiators, too.
Yeah, so it feels like that, and we discussed in the car afterwards, there's a lesson to be learned there, and ideally, you know, that should be have reflections in the modern day of the movie, of Diana's modern day of the movie. But, like, that lesson didn't feel earned, and, like, I kind of forgot about that section until you mentioned it, and it would have just been nice to see Diana in her normal day a bit more, I guess, with Kristen Wiig, like, build that up a bit, like, where there's some kind of friendship. It's the beginnings of a friendship we get to see.
I mean, what we see of Diana in the current present, or in the present, that is 1984, is that for some reason she spent the last 50 years since the war being in the world but not of the world. She's kind of maintained an aloof presence, right? Because she's still kind of hung up on Trevor. She even built a farm in his name. And
yeah, they didn't explain that, did they?
No,
yeah, I was just gonna say that just seems like
we
a
just
random
saw a photo
of
with
a
Trevor
photo.
Ranch.
Yeah.
Exactly.
There's photos of like her at a concentration camp, and I was like, is her at a concentration camp with a young woman, and then a photo of her in color that like she's with an older woman, and I think Yumi, you asked, was that her sidekick or was that the character from the first movie? And I thought it was the woman from the concentration camp, but I assumed that there was going to be a story of like her telling Steve, yeah, I couldn't really connect with the world after you. And then we'd have a flashback.
Yeah, or something. Exactly.
But it never did. Or, you know, like her saying, you know, he sees the ranch photo. I mean, it is a subtle thing and he just smiles. But
it doesn't mean anything to anybody else.
I don't
else.
Know what that means. Did he mention that he had a ranch in Montana? I mean, is that he left it? Without him around, did it fall to the other line of the family? The Kirk side of the family?
Yeah, that's where he grew up.
That's where his great 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 grandson is going to ride motorbikes and look at spaceships.
Correct. What did you guys like?
Bum bags. So many fanny packs and bum bags, and Chris Pine's fascination with them. That was just beautifully observed. The 1980s-ness of it wasn't overdone.
No, And all of the Chris Pine stuff was like his face when he saw the subway. It was that joy in his face when he went down an escalator. All of that was so nice.
Because, you know, you do think of him as the captain of the starship, not realizing that he came from a time when, like, the steam engines were pretty big and there wasn't that many carriages. And just even a jet engine is awesome. Escalators is, I think the escalators is probably more mind-blowing than the train. But, like, it took a while, I think, like, in the first movie to remember he's from World War One, not World War Two.
Correct.
So it is a huge difference for him.
Yeah, I just feel like they breezed past that quite a little bit. I think they didn't, you know, I mean, I don't want to see Chris Pine sitting in the corner of the room sort of just like sucking his thumb because his mind is melting at all the advancement that he's just had. But at the same time, it just like, yes, the escalator scene was cute. The train scene was cute. But then, you know, he's okay with Nike shoes. He spent time without Diana already, because he says he couldn't approach her for a while, which means he's just been walking.
It was like a day, though.
Yeah, but he's just been walking around, like, not freaking out at Ford Mustangs and cars just whizzing by him. You know, it just, again, look, it's a pick at a little thing, but it just feels a little, like, they breezed past that really quickly.
I did like his gag about, like, I looked you up. She said, you look me up in the phone book. And he says, yeah, I guess some things are just future-proof. Not anymore, buddy.
Wait. So what did you like, Bahe?
you know,
Bahe's like, there was a long silence. And then Bahe continued. And then he continued to pick a nit.
I honestly can't think of anything. I'll be perfectly honest. I think it just falls short everywhere. Like, the action wasn't action-y enough. And again, I'll get to this later, but we've seen all the cool bits in the trailers. Honestly, I don't know what about this movie I'll find memorable in 3 weeks.
Like, the swinging across lightning was super memorable, but we saw it in the trailer.
And there was no extension to that in the film, right? It was that same sequence in the trailer. So,
like, I thought she was going to... When we saw that trailer, I can remember seeing that trailer and talking about it. Like, we were wondering, holy shit. Like, I can remember you specifically asking Bahir, wait, has her lasso ever harnessed the lightning? And we were like, what? No.
Yeah.
And that looked like that was going to be the lead up into her, like... Landing on a Learjet and just tearing the door off or something.
Being,
you know, it's going to
cool
be something
moment.
Big.
Yeah.
And it does go nowhere. And I think I do like this, like I mentioned, it's not, they don't overdo it in the 80s, but I do like there's elements of hinting towards things like the inherent sexism of the 80s that Kristen Wiig has to deal with. And like that kind of weird, drunken, just horny guy that she has to deal with. There's like nice hints there, but they don't mind that scene. And I think that leads into what you're saying as well. There are... Everything, I mean, we should probably, but we're down without fine praise, but like everything Gal Gadot does is fantastic.
Absolutely.
We shouldn't have watched that extended sequence of the truck fight either.
Which they released.
That was shared, which they released because that is awesome. They nailed superhero running, like yes. way better yeah. than the Phantom Menace did with the Jedi doing their weird Benny Hill run.
Right.
But just when she gets, like, we don't even see her do a Wonder Woman spin or anything. She just gets out of the car, she's in her outfit. And
yeah.
then
yeah.
she's just running at full tilt and it looks almost completely natural. And then she's leaving Chris behind in the car. And that whole sequence of just her taking things, she kicks the tires on an APC.
Yeah.
And they explode and it goes off the road. And that was just like, that is incredibly smart. You don't see that in an action scene. You know, there's all sorts of cool things. The rocket thing, I was like, what is he doing with that rocket? You know that the RPG yeah. he has that yeah. he launches? And he's like, he just farted into the air. What a dum-dum. What is he doing? Like, what an idiot. He's like the worst person on the team. And then you see exactly what she does with it. And it's like, oh my God, they're the best team of all time.
Exactly. And then all of that seems kind of wasted. Because it isn't built upon. And I think that was my biggest frustration with the action in the film. I think the Russo brothers are a very good example of pulling these kind of things off. And you see it in the first Captain America movie that they did, Winter Soldier, as well, where every action doesn't just have a consequence, it has a resolution as well. So when Sam Jackson is being attacked in the car scene, or when Bucky and Cap are fighting for the first time.
The knife flip. Every time.
Nothing is done because it just looks cool. There is a reason for it. And here, there is so much stuff, like the lightning and the lasso, her having her armor, the gold armor, which we see in the trailer as well. All of it seems like people sat in a room going, that would look really cool on a big screen. But why is she doing it? And like you said, Ian, she needed to swing onto a Learjet and tear open the door, right? Here she just lassos the lightning and then it cuts away to something else.
And we don't even know where she's going, right? It's just like, oh, I'm just going to lasso this. I'm just like, wait, why? Why are we doing this now? And a lot of it felt like that.
But that also came after, the big emotional beat of the movie, which isn't the climax.
Yeah.
And which completely worked for me. And we'll get to that, I think, later on in the spoiler section. But there's a choice that has to be made. And when she makes that choice, and the way they handle that with the other person walking, her running away from the other person. She's literally running away from her problems.
It's really good.
To face another problem. And it's so well done. And then she leaps. And it's just the emotion and the music and everything came together really beautifully for me.
So Ian reminded me of what the one thing I really did like. I think we've talked about how Chris Pine and Gal Gadot's sort of relationship really works very well. I also think the emotional beats here, especially within that relationship, is really, really good. I mean, that moment when they first wake up in the morning and Chris Pine says, you know, this room is perfect. I don't want to leave this room. And she goes,
after
yes,
eating
it
three Pop-Tarts as well.
After eating three Pop-Tarts, right? Like he's sitting in bed just with absolute glee. And I think it's those like really sweet emotional moments really work throughout the film.
Yeah.
I just think everything else around it falls apart. And you're right, Ian, that scene when she is, in inverted commas, running away from her problems is such an emotional beat.
And I think her acting in that is tremendous.
Yes.
I think her face, it's all in her face, and all of that is really, really good.
She's going from sadness to sort of raising into being angry and being
and
sort of
rage, right?
Strong
She's a strong, powerful modern woman. God damn it! And she's going to kick some ass. You're saying like it's a really sweet moment in the bed by here. You've probably no idea. I don't know how much sugar was actually around in 1984 and 1914. That probably wasn't as available as it is now. So Pop Tarts were probably like heroin to him. And having three of them, he was probably tripping so many balls. He was tripping all the balls.
And coffee.
He had three cups of coffee as well. Yeah.
And of course, you know, it goes without saying, like the way they framed Gal Gadot, she is absolutely breathtaking in every scene. The light, the way it bounces off her face is insane. Just for me, the biggest problem with the film, and I think this is partly due to the fact that they've been kind of hamstrung by what has come before, namely Batman v Superman, and the story that they set up there with regards to Wonder Woman, right? And the biggest problem for me is she's been around for 70 years and she's apparently secretly been a superhero because she's still hiding from the public. We see that in the first, you know, 10, 15 minutes of the film. But we get no backstory as to what she's been up to for those 70 years, right? It's a long time to be a superpowered person and to not do anything. But then suddenly in 1984, you get involved in a world-ending plot. But actually, in those 70 years, the world has almost ended many, many times. The Cuban Missile Crisis. There are all of these
things. But see, that's the thing, Uma. She was there. You didn't see her.
No, but in BVS, the whole idea is that Wayne has to convince her that the world is worth saving. Because her whole story is, nah, fuck this. They took my man, and I'm going to be moody all the time, right? And then, like, that's how Zack Snyder set up the damn character. And I think they're trying to fit within that storyline now, which is really hard.
I wasn't thinking about Batman versus Superman or Justice League at all. I was like, no, this makes perfect sense. It's like, I mean, I was just a little bit more backstory than just, you know, three photos in her house and a few pops would have been nice. Or, I mean, they can always go back and do, you know, Wonder Woman 44 or whatever they want to do with that kind of stuff. They have that there, I think, and they probably will. It's just like, you know, life's a series of downbeats. Like, her life has been Empire Strikes Back for quite a long time, maybe. So she's on a long downbeat in the 80s. The 80s were hard all around, you know?
Yeah.
So I could kind of jive with it. I didn't think of the other, being hamstrung by the other portrayals. I just thought that, like, it's world weariness. She's reached the Who Wants to Live Forever part of Highlander. You know, the sad bit before the awesome fight.
For me, another big problem was the actual villains of the piece, right? Because I like Pedro Pascal and Kristen Wiig a lot in the show.
But he looks weird, right? He looks weird in this. I know, and
used to seeing him with a mustache, dude.
It's not
Game of Thrones, in Mando.
I thought you were going to say we're used to seeing him with a bucket on his head, but it wasn't that either. But it's just like, that hairdo isn't flattering at all. And I understand he's supposed to be a smarmy 80s guy. But he just kind of looked odd. And it was weird. I mean, maybe it's the mustache thing, because he looks like he's pursing his lips the whole time.
I just didn't appreciate the lack of motivation for both of these characters. Like, when we were in the car on the way back from the cinema, I said, well, it's not that they made a movie set in the 1980s. It felt like they made it in the 1980s. All of the plot beats were so very basic. And I usually don't have a problem with that if it's executed well. But because I think there were so many holes, I started picking at those holes, right?
Yeah.
I don't know what his motivation is. I don't understand the decision to, at the end of the movie, and yet again we see this in the trailer, to have Kristen Wiig look like a reject from Cats. Like, I much preferred her in her leather skirt, like leopard skin, leopard print, cheetah print thing. She looked much better as a bad guy, right?
Well, I think that whole CGI section we complained about as well. There's a CGI slugfest at the end of the movie, which is what they were doing in the first Iron Man in 2008, you know, Mark Kermode was complaining about on the BBC back then. And it was like, it became a trope that the end of your movie either has a blue light firing into space. This didn't have a blue light firing into space, but it did have a blue light. And you have a CGI fight where there's two, like in Iron Man, it was two metal things fighting where you don't really care about it. In this, it's two female shapes, because it's a bit indistinct, swinging around in mist and fog, which was an odd choice considering how clear things had been. Or like, there's a fight in the White House, and there's a fight in a mall and there's a fight in the desert, and it's completely beautifully lit. And when that truck flip happens, you see it and it looks fuck. And not only that truck flip, I was like, what is she doing and how did that do that? Because that's, yeah, you fuck up the axle on a truck like that, it's going to flip. Like, they thought that much into that. But then at the end, it feels like we're going to have them just swinging around. And it's like, you don't have that feeling of space. You don't have that feeling of where they are in relation to each other. I don't understand how that fight was resolved, because they were both in the water. Do you know what I mean? We'll talk about spoilers, what that is. But there's something that happens that, like, takes Barbara out of it. And it's like, wait, shouldn't that take her out of it as well?
And that's the thing we didn't like about the first film as well. Where at the ending, that slugfest with Ares was a big CGI mess, right? Because after the emotion of what happened with Steve, you just go to a boosh, boosh, bosh. And it just feels a little tropey.
Yeah, he doesn't... We all have no clue what his end game was.
Mm.
Like, we know what he was doing. We know why it was a threat. We know why Wonder Woman has to stop him. There's a kind of an echo towards what her motivation was at the beginning in that sequence we could have lost. And it does give us the wherewithal to have Steve back. But apart from that, and there's no resolution to his storyline either. When it comes to Kristen Wiig, the 80s thing you're talking about is, like, apart from just, like, having her appear in dungarees and have braces, like, it is the She's All That. Is it She's All That? That's the one, right?
Yep.
She's All That plot, where, you know, everyone ignores Kristen Wiig, which is just like, She doesn't change that much. Like, I think she gets rid of like a dumpy skirt. That's it.
She gains confidence, like, Ian. She gains confidence.
Yes.
And she loses the glasses.
Yeah, even without confidence, that like Asian douchebag in the museum, like, he looked slimy. He would have been all over her, like, what, you know.
Also, like, we have no idea why people were mistreating her. Like, it happened so quickly in the film, right?
Yeah.
She just walks into a room. She looks like a new person there as well, because she's only been there for 2 weeks. And somehow everyone's being an asshole based on the fact that she's wearing a dumpy skirt and glasses.
Yeah.
And I think that sort of goes back to your thing about how it feels very 80s, right? Not like it feels like it's set in the 80s. It feels like it was written in the 80s. It feels like such simple shorthand to problems, right? It's just like, oh, she's not the cute popular girl, so she's got big hair, frumpy skirt, and she wears glasses, right? And like Ian said, just shy of putting braces on her.
And then Diana's the cool kid. But then they're like quite subtle with regards to, like, okay, I don't know what Pedro Pascal's up to, but the way that it explained what he's doing,
yes,
is quite smart. Like, they don't spell it out exactly how his abilities work. And I was like thinking, what? How is this working? And then it's like, oh, okay, he's deciding what he's taking as detailed as we'll say. And I was like, okay, now it makes sense, I guess. And that wasn't explained, so I don't think that was an oversight. I think that was like the pictures in Diana's place. It was there as a smart thing, but they didn't build on that foundation of smartness, because then the ending is just like, and then it's not a Care Bear stare that saves the things at the end, but it's close enough.
Yeah.
It's like, we are the power of love.
But I feel that the ending, and I guess we'll explain what the ending is in the spoiler section, but I feel that it was quite anticlimactic, because part of it was because I didn't know Pedro Pascal's motivations as a villain. And I think I was thinking about this last night after watching the film, and I think the only thing I could glean from it is maybe there was a sense of excess, and so he just wanted more of everything, because that's what the 80s were all about. But that is like deep cut, right?
Because he's Donald Trump.
Kind of.
Yeah, but even then, it's not like he's the deep cut that you guys are talking about is that he doesn't want all the money in the world. He doesn't want to be the king of the world. He, you know, it's just
he wants more.
He wants more, but again,
to be popular, to
end?
Be a great guy,
yeah.
But
yeah.
To what?
But
I don't know what that means.
Listen, I think is tying in what Uma is saying, and maybe it seems a bit more smart now. He just wants more, whether it is more money, more power, more everything. And the whole point is, I guess the whole point is that more is never enough. So that could be a thing, but that's a very hard motivation and a hard, like, that has to be the lesson of the whole film, is that more isn't always enough, as opposed to what we
that
got.
That can't be your character's motivation, right?
Yeah. If it's like, it's too ineffable. It's not clear enough.
Yes.
It's not like...
No, and the way they resolved it felt
really
half-hearted as well. By the time you get... Because you've had a big CGI fight and then you want something of a showdown and then it kind of fizzles out.
Yeah, you have new superpowers that are introduced that were never mentioned before, and I was like, what is that? I mean, that's like the giant... It had maybe it's a homage to, we have to put a giant spider in Superman, you know, add something wacky in the final act. I don't know. But that is like, Diana is like at the top of her powers, she's in her silver armor, and then like, it doesn't matter because of something we just came up with.
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
It's like 8-year-old planning of storytelling. And then suddenly Batman turned up, and then the whole planet was overrun by aliens. And then suddenly Tasmanian Devil was there. Have you ever seen that episode of the Taz show? And it's like, and then suddenly it's like the
and
whole story
suddenly,
is. And then suddenly a rock fell on them. And then suddenly.
I will say, I was sitting there thinking to myself, is someone going to show up? Is a Green Lantern going to show up? Superman's not here yet. Batman's not around yet. Is someone going to show up and help her? Because it really felt like I mean, that would have been a cop out, but the story felt like that was where it was going, that someone was going to assist her in defeating this guy. But no.
No, I was going to say it couldn't be Superman, because yet again, in Man of Steel, Zack Snyder made the point of Superman being the first superhero the world has ever seen.
That's
true.
Seen. They only heard Gal Gadot's voice.
Correct.
That's true. Yes.
I'm sure we'll get some hate because it's three guys, you know, giving out about Wonder Woman. But I think we have been very clear that, you know, None of the problems with the film lie with the role of Wonder Woman or Gal Gadot herself or
it's
Chris
the story.
Pine. It's the scaffolding around it.
Exactly.
And the biggest one that is a filmmaking, like, it's jumped into my like top 10 filmmaking mistakes. And I'm not saying that as someone, like, it's just something that breaks the movie for me for something. And you know what I'm talking about. I'll get to the full details and spoilers. But
shall we sit down for this?
Yeah, I think we should.
After we've had, settle down. It's story time. After her big emotional moment, and it's leading up to another huge emotional moment. It's the emotional pinnacle of the entire film. And at this point, I think we've only had a snatch of the iconic, now iconic Wonder Woman theme, which when you nail something like that, you should be using it a lot more. Like, we expected to hear it a lot. I think we only heard it once
in this movie.
Yeah.
In the armor scene, right? I think there was a hint.
Twice?
There was a hint in the beginning.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm waiting for, not only am I waiting for that, I'm waiting for maybe for a more somber take on that, because the electric guitar doesn't suit everything, but it is, you know, it is badass. It had people on their feet when they just played that music, even before you saw Diana in Batman vs. Superman, right?
Yeah.
She just turns up and it's like you hear the guitar and then they show her crossed arms.
Yes.
Awesome. In this, they use the song. From another, it's not even like a classical piece of music that is well associated with another song or a pop song. They use a piece of music that was written for another movie and that is very identifiable for the other movie, and also has a Wikipedia entry list of other uses from its original usage that is like, I had to scroll 3 times to get past it. And I felt like, you know, there's that scene where she kicks somebody, Wonder Woman, and it's like, she arches her back and her foot goes out. She's standing like, it's not like a ballet pose, but it's just like, you can see her whole body has been pushed into this kick.
Yeah.
That's what this moment did to me, and it kicked me out the wall and out of the cinema and out of enjoying the story. And it was like, I was so mad because we'll get to, I think the spoilers will reference another piece of music that could have been used in its place that would have actually tied things together nicely. But it would be like having, you know, the Steve Rogers picking up Mjolnir in Avengers, spoilers for Avengers Endgame, and having like the theme from Shawshank playing or the Spider-Man theme, you know what I mean? It would just be odd.
Yeah.
And I'm really familiar with the works of this composer. So when I heard that, it fucked me up. I was just mad. I was so mad. And then I realized what they could have had, and then I was even madder. And you heard, I brought this up 3 or 4 times on the way home last night. I'm going to bring it up again in spoilers. It's infuriating because I think it takes from her. It's no longer her moment. It should be her moment. I was with the movie. I was with Wonder Woman the whole way through this. And then I felt I was robbed of the emotional catharsis that was supposed to come from that moment.
No, and also it's absolutely inexcusable for a $200 million movie to not have her own original music when you have a composer like Hans Zimmer.
Which they already have.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's what's terrible. And like you said, Ian, if you're lifting a song as well, then maybe take a piece of music that hasn't been used 100 times already, right? It just feels like such a cop-out.
Go through your YouTube sound library and look for something else that it's not on every single unboxing video because...
Wait. On that note, let's do spoilers. But before we do spoilers, if you haven't seen the movie yet, go check out Wonder Woman. If you live in Malaysia, you can actually catch it in cinemas. If you live elsewhere in the world, I'm not sure. America, you can watch it on HBO Max on the 25th of December on Christmas Day. But it really depends what the current state of your country is in regarding COVID and quarantine. But do let us know when you've seen it. Reach out on all of our social medias. That's GogglerMY. You can also email us on podcast@goggler.my. And don't forget to check out the website, www.goggler.my.
And let us know if the music does the same thing to you when you see it, and see if you recognize what the fuck I'm talking about or if I'm just a crazy person.
All right. And now we are going to go into spoilers. You have been warned.
This is where you insert the theme. 30 seconds of it.
Which they didn't even have the courtesy to put in the film.
For me, to begin the spoilers, there are no spoilers. You've seen everything in the trailer.
Yeah.
Spoilers is that there's nothing to hide. It's nothing to hide. There was one shot, I think, of Maxwell Lord in the trailers holding the stone, right? Or holding...
Yes.
It looked like the stone. It looked like three fingers. Didn't know what the fuck it was.
It was him on the desk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there was so many, you know... possibilities. Wonder Woman says it herself before, as we sat down into this movie, the whole world is like, felt like a promise, right? And I was thinking, I remember reading Justice League International comics, and I barely remember Maxwell Lord. It was back, Maxwell Lord funded the Justice League International. I was talking last night about some storyline. There's a well-known storyline where Wonder Woman breaks his neck because it's the only way to stop him having absolute power over the world. Well,
yeah,
that sounds familiar. So it feels like it's in a draft, but like there's no ties. Like for all their ballyhooed Snyderverse stuff, and even like they didn't even try to put in a few sops to that. Like the stone doesn't seem to have any connection to anything. Whereas I thought it would have been very easy. Like you could actually probably drop in three or four, you know, pieces of what did they say elements of power or whatever they call it. Not the fan. They're Infinity Stones. Let's call them Infinity Gems.
Pretty much.
You know, you would have thought they could have dropped in something there, or a Green Lantern ring, or some enemy from that, or something. It was nothing. Or even when it mentioned a god, I thought there would be. That god might turn up.
Ian, you're assuming there was planning in the DC universe. There is no planning.
But this is the least available. Like I was looking at the shops in the background. I thought Commander Salamander was a character. I looked it up. No, it's just a store in DC that closed in the 80s, apparently. So that's or it's a band. I'm not sure. I didn't read the full article, but like there were enough weird little names in the background that I'm not sure. Apparently, they were niche color for people who lived in Washington DC in 1984, but. It would have been quite easy to drop. Like you could just walk into a comic book and throw a stone at the DC section, and you probably would have gotten some reference that you could have used to just make it feel a little bit more tied in.
But yeah. Even if you didn't, even if you wanted to make a completely standalone thing, which was its own thing, that would be fine. But at least put more effort within the movie universe to try and explain it. It felt so rushed and half-hearted. It's like, oh, look, it's the... She picks up the stone and then she's like, oh, it's the writing of the gods. You know, not Loki. Copyright, Marvel, Cinematic Universe. And then there is a five-minute section where they try to tie it back to Mayan mythology or Incan mythology, and that's it.
She's like, I went through all these microfiche and I did everything, and my last lead is a flyer I found...
Outside of Galaxy Records.
Like Galaxy Records?
Yeah.
Like, what? 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 What?
Yeah.
What?
And no, I don't know... Like, I have no idea why they felt they needed to write that scene into this film.
And in that, during that scene, Steve and Diana are talking about her like Wonder Woman. Like, the people in the room know she's Wonder Woman.
Mm.
And the people in the room don't know she's Wonder Woman.
No. And I'm like, she has a secret identity. Nobody in the world knows who she is.
I also... They work at a museum. They could have just had. I've looked through everything. I can't find. Is it like they're trying to say like, oh, it's lost to education or to, you know, history professors? And it's like this other guy has it. Like that could just be. I found a book that was like at the very back because of my new superhuman speed reading powers. Like it felt weird. Like I mean, it was one of those things that like added to the overall feeling of first or second draftness of certain things.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that's my problem with it, and that's why when I left the movie, I said to you guys, it feels like a very Zack Snyder production. I mean, like, Patty Jenkins is, in my opinion, a much better filmmaker because I think she lights everything much better for starters, so you can actually see what's going on. But
except that maybe he stepped into the director's chair for that third act fight.
I think that one maybe they used up a lot of their budget in that scene in the desert and went, oh man, the CG's not looking good. Let's make things darker. But when I say like a Zack Snyder production, because do you remember that? I think it was Every Frame of Painting, right? The YouTube channel.
Either that or Nerdwriter, I can't remember.
Oh, it was Nerdwriter who was talking about Zack Snyder's Moments Not Scenes.
Yeah.
And this movie is full of moments, not scenes. Everything we spoke about in the review was a moment. We love that chase scene in the desert, moment. We love the scene in the White House, moment. We loved all of those bits with Steve discovering the wonder of the 1980s, also a moment. And yet, whenever they tried to do scenes, it felt either not badly written, but kind of we got short shrifted on it, right? So the scene with the guy who tells them about the Mayan mythology was just very washed over. The scene with Pedro Pascal trying to explain what his powers do to the emir was very confusing.
There was Bahir saying as well, like even something as simple as when Kristen Wiig with her newfound confidence walks into a party. During that, it's like we've already seen her feeling herself when she tries on the dress and the shoes, and it's like that's a cute moment, I suppose. But like, it feels then should have made it, the entrance should have been even grander if in order to reflect that, or lose that scene completely. But then that scene she's entering, I think Frankie Goes to Hollywood is playing, you know, and it's a 1980s song, and they never get to the chorus. It's like, what's the or I think it was Frankie Goes to Hollywood, or it sounded like that, but it also had hints of Tears for Fears. It's like, you have access to all these 80s music,
and it also that weird thing of there's a point where a lot of older movies would just play the choruses, right? Because you know these songs, you get up for it. And this movie tried to get away from that by playing the verses and not the choruses. So you just go sitting there, go, what is the song? I don't know it. And it sort of, then what is the point?
I saw Rio in the credits by Duran Duran. When was that played?
I don't know.
Yeah, I didn't spot that either.
It could be a pre-chorus or something, the pre-verse. Just why would you even do that?
Yeah, I mean, there's something to be said for doing an 80s movie that doesn't lean into all that, because they didn't. That was just that was just pop culture at the time. It wasn't like, you know, there was also an awful lot of crap that you know, that we don't listen to. That it's probably better to get some of that and stick that in there as well for a fair and balanced view. But yeah, just not fully thought out ideas.
Yeah.
Also, just, and this is a problem that I had with The Dark Knight Rises as well, where, because you're making a series of cool moments, you forget that the logic is important.
Yeah.
And when a movie has this many holes, then you start tearing apart the logic because you're not actually completely emotionally invested in it. So how people get from place to place in no time at all. How there's a fight in the White House and suddenly Barbara Minerva, Kristen Wiig's character, shows up and she's inside the White House because no security, they'll just let anyone into that place in the 80s. And, you know, little things like that defy logic. But it's a cool scene because she shows up to save Pedro Pascal. So,
yeah, Chris Pine gets to say the words, invisible jet. And it's like, yeah, but I didn't need it. Like, I didn't need that moment. And, like, she used her ID card to get in there, so everyone knows she stole that plane. She used her Diana Prince ID card, authorization card, to get into the Smithsonian. And they just leave. The Smithsonian has an airfield. And they leave jets fully fueled up?
Yeah.
Hey.
I guess.
Hey. That is the least logical problem, given that Steve Trevor, who's been dead for 70 years and last flew a fucking biplane.
More in common. That has more in common with a lawnmower in the 80s than a jet plane.
Exactly.
Even an old first gen jet plane.
Just jumps into a jet and goes, all right, this must be the start button.
Yeah.
I got this.
Weird. Yeah.
That was weird.
But it was a cute moment where she goes, oh, whoops, I forgot. He says, the way I fly, they'll never see me. It's like, oh, wait, I forgot to tell you about radar. And he's like, oh, shit. Like, that's, again, another great cute moment.
Yeah.
That scene as a thing doesn't make sense, right? There's so many plot holes. Like you said, Ian, she walks in flashing her ID card, so they all know it's her. Then she jumps into a plane that's been parked there for Lord knows how long, which happens to have a full tank of gas or rocket fuel, whatever.
Enough to get them to Cairo.
And I was gonna say, can those things fly from Washington, D.C. to Egypt? I don't think they can, you know. I don't think those
That's why they need aircraft carriers, right?
Yeah, I don't think they can fly that far and definitely not fly back without stopping over for petrol or gas.
And also they landed in a forest where it's like, I know the there's like a road in the forest where they come back to, and it's like, I understand the plane's invisible, but the wings are still going to hit those trees.
Also, how do you find your plane once it's invisible?
They joked about that where she had done it. Like, I mean, that's also a new power that is just, we're doing it now. It's like, if we'd seen it once or twice earlier, if she'd used that instead of using the cameras in the mall, then that would be fine. But they can't introduce something like that because then it changes the character for the whole movie, and they didn't want to address that question, but they couldn't figure out a way to address this question. The only thing this plane would have had a full tank of if they're sitting that long would be birds and bugs.
Yeah.
The other thing as well, like, there is something in the idea, though, of having her as an avatar of the magical world. I think that they've leaned into this a bit more in the comics, where some of the Justice League stuff, I think after I stopped reading it, they were fighting like fantasy creatures or elves or whatever else. It was like, and there's a good point where, like, that's the knowledge she brings to the team.
Yeah, right.
And there is a good idea in how that crosses over with technology, and there's hints of that here. But the idea of, well, through these particles, I'm basically touching everybody, so basically all these wishes can be granted, was like, you've gone too far. I mean, yeah. Just it doesn't have to be. Maybe just don't have. It'd be, the easier thing is to go back to the beginning of the script and say that you just need to be 1 foot away from it instead of touching the Dreamstone, right? It's easier to do that.
Or eye contact or something.
Yes, eye contact.
Yeah, instead of physical touch, right?
Yeah.
But I just felt that the resolution to that was, I didn't like it at all. And I don't know whether it's just because of the year we've had, but the fact that a good speech can just change everybody's mind and they want to suddenly do good, yeah, doesn't convince me. Like the guy sitting in a bunker going, I wish I had nuclear weapons because I want to, yeah, fuck up those guys on the other side. Hears a speech from Wonder Woman and just goes, I renounce my wish.
That's not going to work. That only really works against, like, you know, Republicans on their deathbed.
It doesn't even work now when I'm down the road during MCO and I can't get the last bag of fucking rice, okay? And this guy wants nuclear weapons and renounces his wish? Come on.
Like, he's in a bad place. Like, I wish he had some therapy and a support group that would help him. He's obviously in a very bad place, and people who are in a bad place like that, they ain't going to renounce shit.
But also, they just... they just hear her voice. They don't even know who's speaking right now.
It's a glowing orange
light thing. And they just go, you know what? That orange light on the TV box is right.
It's the power of truth compels you. Her lasso doesn't just make you truthful. It's powered by truth.
It shows you the truth as well.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, there's, when they saw that yellow light, they were like, ah, yellow, it must be true. Unlike Green Lantern, which is the color of delays.
Yeah.
Because somehow the truth is enough to convince you. But then what about all those people who just want to see the world burn? They've made a ton of wishes too, right?
I mean, Uma, the truth will set you free was sitting right there. I mean, come on, man.
For me, this felt like The Dark Knight Rises with that stuff. Just... it was easy cop-outs and solutions to really big problems that you've set up. It's like, oh, look, they raided the stock exchange, which means Bruce Wayne has no money. Wait, that doesn't make any logical sense. Why would any trades go through when there was an attack on the stock exchange? So it's things like that. It's like, hey, Barbara, we'll be there in a few seconds, so you just make your way over to Galaxy Records, so we'll fly over from Cairo in minutes. Yeah.
Yeah, like they set up in this that either everyone revokes their wish or they kill Maxwell Lord. And as I said earlier in the comics, there's a thing where she breaks his neck and is seen doing it, and everyone turns against her.
Yes.
And I was like, that must be what they're doing. So like Wonder Woman 84 to 92 is like Wonder Woman's give peace a chance, you know, publicity trail, or, you know, kind of winning the nation over. Or it's, you know, they're doing
she's
a Dark Knight
Rises
thing.
Yeah.
He's in hiding or something. Or she has to lose her Diana Prince identity because she waved her card and they know that's her. And they just... they didn't do that at all. And it, in the end, we were talking in the car about how that's maybe a step too far. But having, again, if you're doing this as an arc, having it where she is this bastion of goodness and light, and having to, when she's faced with no other choice, she'll do something that Batman won't do. Superman murdered a load of people in Snyderverse, right?
Yeah. But that was the problem with it, right?
Yeah, I mean, in Superman, it's like people were like, okay, maybe he murdered Zod, okay, fine. But like Batman is like, he's not really supposed to. So when they broke Batman with the killing thing, it was like, okay, this whole universe is fucked. This is the injustice of the movie theater. Like, this is like Earth 2 or whatever. So I think it would have led to something super powerful when she was down, she was beaten. She had, I mean, the power of truth, I think, it's not as good as a good backhand to break his neck, you know what I mean? It was like, and knowing that he has a kid and all that kind of stuff, it would have torn her up, and it would have led to, I don't know, character development and, you know, lots of plots that we could deal with in the next movie.
You mean planning for the next movie, Ian?
Yeah, like I know.
They planned for the previous one? Yeah.
Yeah. But that's the problem here as well, because she doesn't have a substantial arc. In the beginning of the film, you think it is going to be a substantial arc, and it would have tied into exactly what you wanted, Ian, because she says, oh, as a kid, I didn't realize the value of this lesson. Like the lesson of the gladiator scene in the beginning. And I thought, okay, that's going to come back, because somehow as a grown-up, she only at the end of this movie does she realize what her mother and her mentor were trying to tell her.
But the shortcuts to get what you want makes the thing that you want worth less.
Yes. Well, that was one lesson. But then there was, it's also don't cheat to win. It's also you're not ready to win yet. There were like five lessons.
If you're not ready to win yet, it sounds like just, you know, don't look behind you when you're on your horse at full speed, you dumbass. Like, that is actually the real lesson of the beginning of this movie. And it's a shitty lesson badly taught. Like, it's great seeing Robin Wright give the lesson, but it's also like, what? It's like, you don't start, you're talking to a child and you don't start with, you missed a flag in the relay race, so technically you cheated, so you can't win. And because the kid is just like, if I'd nailed the target, I would have won. And they never bring up the fact that, well, she said you take a shortcut, but I don't know, they don't have action replays. She says, I understand the thing, but maybe she's run the track when no one's on it. She doesn't realize there's a secret hidden relay thing to hit. And just, yeah, actually, that was muddled. It's like, this easier, I'm getting, I don't know, my old age, I'm getting really annoyed at like when there's an easier, simpler way to do something or a better way to say something.
And yeah, and that doesn't play out at the end, right?
Yeah, and I think muddled is interesting because there are, like you guys have said, that lesson that she's taught is, there's five or six there. So it just feels like the writers went, someone will pick, you know, you pick the lesson that you learn from the movie, right? Here's six. Pick one that fits best your personal journey throughout this film. And at the end of it, you have a lesson. But there's no real sort of, what has Diana learned from that opening sequence of her flashback and the end of the film? What has she taken from that trip? Because you open the film, well, the second sequence is her saying, it took me a while to learn this lesson. What is this lesson?
And how have you learned it?
And how have you learned it? Yeah, exactly.
And that brings me back to being hamstrung by the previous movies, because she can't have. Because she only really learns that lesson when Bruce Wayne sends her the email with the photo, right? Because that's when she decides to step up to the plate, show herself, and save the world. And so I don't know, and they seem to be trying to stick with that narrative when they don't really have to anymore, because nobody cares.
I mean, the thing she learned is she learned how to fly.
Well, okay, did you find, I know it was a big emotional moment in the film, and I was caught up with it when it was happening, but I thought it took away from her leaps and her running and all of that stuff, because that was one. I mean, in the later comics, she does fly.
Like in Wonder Woman flies, it's part of her power set for the last decade or so. Up until that point, it was big leaps and holding onto Green Lantern's foot while they flew over or whatever.
With this, it felt too similar to the action set that Superman does. They didn't make it her own.
The power set, you mean?
The power set.
Well, I mean, I think she's joining with the wind. I think they made it. He's flying because he's Kryptonian bollocks.
Yeah.
She's flying because she's become one with the wind. I think it kind of ties in nicely to her
conversation with Steve.
The mystical roots of things, the Greek aspect of it. Like, she's literally, like, she's, the way she's flying is very different. She's moving her hands. She's pushing on the air, and I think that's quite cool. She throws her lasso. Whoever came up with whoever their lasso person is on this, their lasso ideas person, they're so good. They're like, she throws the lasso, turns it into a propeller, and that pulls her forward. And that's just like, that's very different. And then we come back to my biggest problem of the movie, which is when she's jumping really high. She's above the clouds. She's super annoyed. She's really sad. And the wind is kind of going over her hands. And she's starting to think back to what Steve said about, you got to work with it, and you got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them, you know, all that stuff. There's a couple of beats start, and I was like, oh my God, they're going to play that song from the song that plays, the Zimmer song that plays when Clark steps out of the spaceship at the end, at the middle of Man of Steel.
Yes.
And it's the first time he has the outfit on, and he puts his fist on the ground, and all the rocks go, and the music starts building, boom, boom. And I was like, wow, that'd be a really nice way to tie together the movies in the Warner Brothers DC superhero cinematic universe, that they would have these two characters from very different worlds, and yet the same music is playing in the background. It's almost as if their heroism brings them together. It's their shared, oh no, we're just going to use the music from Sunshine.
You mean you assume they had planning?
We're going to get you a t-shirt that says, you assume they had planning?
Yeah.
It's just, we have to get matching, you know, like the Batman 66 henchman t-shirts. Yours just said, you assume they had planning?
Yeah.
Mine is just Adagio in D minor, motherfucker. That song for me is so associated with Sunshine. And it's not even that Sunshine, I like Sunshine, I love Sunshine as a movie, but John Murphy's a composer who also did that amazing theme for 28 Days Later.
Yeah.
And like, I listen to themes when I'm working. It's like music themes with no words are better for when you're writing. Otherwise, you end up writing down the lyrics to Pearl Jam songs.
Correct.
In the middle of your article. And it is a cool moment, and I sent you guys the clip earlier when Captain Canada is on the surface of this Icarus 2, if you haven't seen Danny Boyle's Sunshine. But that music, it permeates that movie.
Yeah. Like,
that theme runs throughout that film, and it's a really powerful building piece of music that John Murphy is really good at. And if Sunshine had disappeared without trace, and I'd seen it 20 years ago, or 13 years ago, and forgotten about it, that would have worked perfectly fine. But I think that music is so well used. The reference I come up with is when we were watching Triple Frontier and you see they play The Chain, and after The Chain, the beginning of The Chain, or the mid section of The Chain being associated, Fleetwood Mac's The Chain, being so associated with the Formula One on ITV for decades, that was that song. I never heard the rest of that song until Guardians of the Galaxy. I'm an awful philistine when it comes to listening to old music. If I've heard it, I think there's no need to search stuff out. And when I heard that bit, and it's like, oh my God, Guardians of the Galaxy made it feel new and fresh again. And Triple Frontier made it feel old and baggy again.
Yeah.
And they fucked up. You look at something like Perks of Being a Wallflower, they chose Heroes by David Bowie because these kids wouldn't know it, but also it would have more emotional impact than the Fleetwood Mac song that's in the book,
yeah,
apparently.
Right.
And in this, it just, I said earlier, again, it's like the Avengers. It's like Steve having the hammer, and then fucking, I don't know, like fucking Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny starts playing Bikini. You know, it's just like, it's a mismatch.
But that's the problem with the whole movie, in that there were a lot of mismatches like that. They forgot to cash in on the scenes that would likely incite a reaction from the audience. Like when the truck flip happens, it happens and it's great. But there isn't that, because she's under the truck before it. So there isn't enough of that build-up. Before Steve picks up that hammer, there's enough of a build-up that you don't know what's going to happen. You think it's going to happen. What's going to happen? And then it happens, right? And then,
well, let's say he throws the hammer first. The hammer hits Thanos in the face. And you're like, who did that?
What? And then his hand reaches down and picks it up. And you get the gasp from the audience. That's what I want when I go to the cinema, right? I mean, over the last 3 years, it's happened twice. It was the hammer. And even when I saw it with a regular audience, because I saw Endgame a few times, first time was obviously with a bunch of stupid, crazy fans, and then everyone was cheering. But even in a regular mom and pop audience, you had a gasp. And the second time was in The Last Jedi, when the ship goes into the other one and splits it in two.
Yes.
And no matter who you're watching with, you go,
the Hodor, the Hodor, yeah.
Hodo.
The silence, Hodo, no, right?
What's her name? Honda? Hondor? What's her name?
Hodor.
Dern maneuver.
Hodor is Game of Thrones.
The Dern maneuver.
Yeah, the Dern maneuver, right?
The Dern maneuver. Yeah, let's do that. Yeah.
The Dern stratagem.
And here in this movie, we only got it in the mid-credit sequence. And that's saying something, when the biggest cheer you get in the film is because of Linda Carter, right?
Is a joke casting for Linda Carter, yeah.
I went through my range of emotions as that was one. Oh, there's one girl over the left hand side who is losing her shit, and I am so happy for her.
Right?
I am so happy for her that she likes that.
Yeah,
I loved. I grew up on Wonder Woman because like repeats were the way, and I kind of, when it was happening, I was going through a range of emotions. I was like, what's this? This doesn't look like Diana. And then it's like, oh, hang on. And then I simultaneously remembered that she had been cast in it and then realized she hadn't been in the movie so far, because that news did come out, right, that she had a role or something. And then she does something and turns around and talks, and the sound mix was bad. There's something, her voice was pitched up, modulated or something, or maybe they wanted her to sound cuter or something, but it sounded, again, you know, her voice, whether she's gotten, her voice has got cracked, changed over age, whatever that, it felt like they didn't leave her natural voice in it.
No, you're right, because we hear her natural voice in Supergirl. Because she's in the show. She's in the TV show.
And it's fine. There's nothing wrong with her. But it's like, she has this kind of, oh, I've done this all before kind of thing. And it's like, what? What the fuck? Ugh.
Yeah.
I could have done without that. I actually thought they were going to tie into something else. When they start mentioning the fact that it was a dream stone, I was wondering whether, you know, Morpheus was going to escape his cage in the 1980s and come and reclaim his amulet. And that would be the end of Pedro Pascal. He'd rip the power from him and condemn him to hell and be like, oh, coming soon, DC's Sandman movie. And it's like, nope.
No, Netflix has the rights for that.
And I think just to talk about that sequence, and again, it's also really telling that those two ladies who were sitting to my left in front of me freaking out at Linda Carter. That was the only time throughout the entire film they were freaking out. There was no noise coming out of them at all throughout the whole thing.
Oh, they jumped up and started clapping.
At that last bit, they were just losing their shit. And I'm, like you say, Ian, I am so happy for them that they got that moment. But I'm like...
And we did get some of those moments. I was laughing. Well, there's the Irish bit for
the Irish start.
Were we the only ones laughing at that? And they're like, well, who are these anti-Irish people in the back row? It's like, it's me. They're talking about me. Someone wishes that all the Irish would leave the country.
Yeah.
And I was like, Jesus. I mean, I knew, Malaysia's changed. It felt like I was being called out. But there were some other moments as well where I laughed at the kind of the fun they were having. Like, it was, I think it was mostly Steve and Diana. But also, those to come back to what you said, Uma, about the moments, those laughs were never, either we'd seen them in the trailer, in which case they felt rough because they had, like, trailer timing.
Yes.
Or they weren't given the beat to kind of the breed. Like, the Steve Pop-Tart things only came, like, funny to me afterwards. The bum bag thing occurred to me when he was on the street, as opposed to that every single outfit had a bum bag. Like, every single one he tried on. I mean, it was also a kind of a gag that he, you know, the outfit that she picked for him was, like, the outfit she wears in her normal day. But, yeah.
Yeah, and I think, and again, I go back to the fact that all these moments, all these sort of, all these big heroic moments that Diana Prince has, we've seen in the trailer or in these extended trailers, right? That fight in the desert, they've released it. The cool moment in the beginning, they've released it.
Her popping the wing armor off.
We saw it. And again, I'm sorry to spoil it. We're in the spoiler session, but that was it. What you saw in the trailer is what's in the movie. There's no bit before that. There's no bit after that. She pops it off and that's it. That's what we see. Her swinging off the lightning. Exact same shots you saw in the trailer. And again, like you just said, Ian, it feels like they're trailer shots. They were shots that they've designed in the movie just for the trailer because they don't fit in the movie. There's nothing after that. There's nothing before that to have brought up that scene. So it just feels wasted.
And in tension with that, you have, I've forgotten Kristen Wiig's comic name. Cheetah, is it?
Cheetah,
yeah.
Yeah, I keep wanting to say Cheetara, but that's the one from the
Thundercats.
The Thundercats.
Yeah.
Like, there's a scene where she is wailing on Wonder Woman's wing armor, and it's like she's tearing it apart. She's tearing apart this mythical armor that held back the hordes of humanity while the Amazons escaped to the Mascara.
Held back men.
Yes. Yeah, all the women were like, I wouldn't do that, love. And that's a cool, there's a cool point of view shot where you see that happening. We should have had that shot when she was flying in and the gun turrets were going off.
Yes.
Like to see why does she need this armor? But it's like, she, like you said, she's riding the lightning so she can go home to change into her armor quickly enough because she knows she's fighting all of humanity when she goes to get Pedro Pascal, which I think would have been a way to do it. It was like he's commanding people to come protect him or something.
Given that there was that foreshadowing earlier on, you would think so.
Yeah.
But no.
Yeah, and if you've made it this far again, because I don't know. Sometimes one of these days we're going to get picked up and torn apart, and I think these nitpicks are the things that happen when, when I was atomic smashed out of the wall of the cinema by the Hulk. I was the Thor punched out of the cinema by the music thing. When a movie loses you, you start noticing these things.
Yeah,
and that's sad, and it's the last thing you want.
And I don't know, and I think there's enough in the film that will appeal to kids, right? And I think there's a lot of those moments, yet again, where people can look up in awe and go, this is amazing. And in that sense, the movie works on that level. There is a certain amount of joy when you watch Wonder Woman doing the thing she does.
Mm.
You just need to build around that and have more of a plot and a narrative and a storyline, because I think it's stuff like that that gives superhero movies a bad name. When it doesn't feel like it's been well thought out or structured or makes narrative sense.
And in this case, there is one thing that is perfectly plotted out. And it's, again, we keep coming back to it. It's Diana and Steve. And it's that, like, she, what would you give up to have the one thing in the world that you want. And that is a you know, that is the statue. That is the 3D print in the middle that's not being supported by the rest of the movie. You don't see Kirsten Wiig. You don't see Kirsten Wiig reckoning with what it means to have this thing. Like, she obviously she should struggle and she should she doesn't struggle. She should struggle and then come out, I'm better off. And that's what makes her a villain. Similar with Pedro Pascal. But instead, we just get him going, I need to feel better again. I have a headache.
And that's the theme of the film. And so everyone in the film should struggle with that. But we don't. They don't. So actually, it would have been such a powerful moment or movie, even, if Pedro Pascal, Kristen Wiig, and Gal Gadot all struggled with that. What would you give up to get the thing you wanted most in the world?
Yeah.
Ugh. It feels like a wasted opportunity. And I have to say, Gal Gadot is amazing, and she is my Wonder Woman now. For the longest time, Linda Carter was my Wonder Woman. But I see her, and I'm like, wow, you inhabit this role completely. From the outfits you wear to just that cool swagger when you walk into a room, it's very cool. And I think she deserves a better film.
And it is nice in that I think in the... She shows a bit of leg when she's going to the gala premiere, but most of her civilian gear is just like sexy pantsuits.
Oh yeah, yeah. So she's not in the outfit much, right? She's fighting in pantsuits for most of the film.
Yeah,
I think there's a lot of spectacle in the film. It just feels a little empty at times, and I think that was my biggest problem with it. I had a fun time at the cinema. It could be also because I haven't been to the cinema in a long time, but it's not the kind of movie that I'm going to go back and watch again and again.
No. I want to go watch the original one now, because there's the No Man's Land scene.
Yeah.
But then the movie continues to be good after that.
Correct.
I mean, the we talked earlier about the other stuff, but I think about the ending with Ares. But even that, there's a reveal there that you're like, what? But yeah, I want to watch that again now.
And David Thewlis is always awesome.
Yeah.
All right. Wonder Woman 1984 is in cinemas right now in Malaysia. Not everywhere, because where we are in the Klang Valley is still under CMCO. So if you live in the Klang Valley, you may have to go all the way to Putrajaya to watch it. However, Penang, Malacca, places that aren't under lockdown or partial lockdown, cinemas are still open, so you can watch it there. For the rest of you, if you're listening from anywhere else in the world, in America, 25th of December on HBO Max, and you're going to have to check your local listings for it. Let us know what you think once you've seen the film. Are we completely off base? Did you watch a different movie? If so, tell us about that. You can reach out on GogglerMY and also email us on podcast@goggler.my.
And let us know if you make it to the end of the podcast by sending us the code word, which is Asteria.
Thanks so much for listening. Ian, Uma, and Bahir signing out of the Goggler Podcast.